When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Featuring Joe Sweeney from Thinking Sideways podcast and filmmaker Vincent Caldoni. This is The Shocking Details.
All right, we're rolling.
Okay. Oh, we got the red dot. Okay. Here we go. Hey there. Welcome to another episode of The Shocking Details. I'm Joe, joined as usual by
Vincent Caldoni.
And we're going to talk about, well, what are we going to talk about? Well, as you all know, we're just out of the month of October, and we celebrated Halloween month with a lot of grisly tales of the macabre. Yeah, scary stories about body snatching and murder and dissection and a demon that steals your soul in your sleep. But now it's November, so time to get back to normal. And so we've got a more wholesome, uplifting story for you this week. We're going to talk about murderers who disposed of the evidence by chemical means. That's right. Our favorite acid bath murderers. Yeah, because there have been a few serial killers who actually put their victims in vats of sulfuric acid, which is kind of gross, actually. But
okay, so I know some of you out there, some of you youngsters probably think this technique was invented by Walter White in the TV series Breaking Bad. You are, of course, correct. But some people did it in Europe nearly a century before is proof that time travel exists.
Yes.
Walter White was a time traveler.
It's incontrovertible, yeah.
Headcanon for Breaking Bad. He traveled through time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we'll discuss that later in the theory section.
Yeah. All right. So who do we got? Who do we got first here?
Let's start out with, well, he's not really a hero. He's a straight up villain, but it begins in 1944 in September when John George Haig committed his first acid bath murder.
Ooh. But actually, it doesn't. The first acid bath murder that we know of was in 1925.
That we know of.
That we know of. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Because see, what's cool about this episode is we've got dueling acid baths.
I know. Dun,
dun, dun, dun, dun. Acid bath killers.
Yeah. So which was better? That's what we got to decide here, right?
We're going to lay out the facts and you can decide. We might even do a really macabre poll on the Facebook page.
Yeah. Which one of these guys do you like better? And by the way, there's some relation between these cases because it's believed that one inspired the other.
That makes sense. I could see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So where do we start?
Well, where do we start? Well, our first killer was a French dude named Georges Alexandre Sallet. Although the French will tell you that he was not actually French because he was born in Trieste, Italy. Although the Italians will tell you that no, he was actually of Greek descent and not really an Italian at all. And the Greeks have not, so far, have yet to push the blame off onto somebody else. So.
But, he's a real hot potato.
Yeah, he definitely is. Nobody wants to take credit for this guy. But he was born in 1878 in Trieste, which is like way as far east in Italy as you can get outside of the boot. It's way over there by the Balkans on the mainland, that's not in the boot. It's up in the continental part of Italy, right?
Yeah. It's a beautiful place, yeah.
I'd never been there. I've seen pictures of it. It looks like a really beautiful town, actually.
It's really cool.
But anyway, he's born in Trieste. He migrated to France at a young age and studied at the University of Marseille, where he took chemistry classes, among other things. He also studied law, and eventually he did become a lawyer. Oh. And I don't know if he found legal practice to be boring, or maybe it just was not remunerative enough. But he decided to go into financial fraud instead. He cooked up a cool scheme to con some life insurance companies. And he had a couple of girlfriends who, by the way, happened to be sisters.
That's how do you get away with that?
How does some guys get away with that kind of thing? Because I never could do that. Hey, I think your sister's hot. What do you? No, it doesn't work out.
Were they cool? I guess what was the dynamic? Were they trying to get one over on the other, or were they just like, it's cool?
I don't
sleep with my sister.
I think that these women were, who by the way were Bavarian, rather loose morals. Because as you'll see shortly here, do you want to tell us about the sisters? You know something about these two.
So they were the two. So George's two girlfriends were Bavarian. Their names were Catherine and Philomene Schmidt. Sarai found two men who were older and had issues, and frankly had one foot in the grave. They're not going to be around much longer. So Schmidt sisters each married one of these guys.
Which is one of the reasons I suspect that these girls were kind of somewhat loose morals, maybe.
I guess so. They were not doing so great.
Yeah.
not spreading a lot of goodwill in the world.
No. So
at this point, then, it's just a matter of getting life insurance on them and hastening up their demise.
Exactly. A little poison or a push down the stairs, whatever, you know. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The hitch was that life insurance companies are usually kind of reluctant to insure old sick people.
Yeah.
Aha. So Serret got around that by recruiting another conspirator, Louis Chambon du Verger, to impersonate the victims.
Yeah.
Du Verger was a defrocked Catholic priest, by the way. So he's
quite the cast of characters we've got going in this story, I think.
The shade of these guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm sure he would have had a really interesting and fruitful criminal career, but he met a sad end. We're going to get to that in a second.
Yeah. But the way it worked is that Louis Chambon de Verger would go in for these medical examinations for the insurance companies and impersonated the old sick husband. And of course, he was always found to be in good health. And so, voila, the insurance policy would be issued. So, yeah. And that is just a matter of waiting for the insured guy to die. And of course, that could take years if you let nature take its course. Because I don't know if you noticed this, but even old, very, very sick people have a way of hanging on for a long time sometimes. They really do. And, of course, they wouldn't get them insured and then just immediately bump them off. Yeah, that would be a little too obvious. Yeah. But they did move the process along by means of usually poison. And I've never heard of, but I've heard that they used other methods as well, but that's rather unspecific that I haven't been able to find any specifics. Like, did they push somebody down the stairs or take him hunting and have blow his head off or something accidentally? Yeah, I know. Usually the means was poison. And so these guys would die, and then they would collect a healthy benefit in life insurance. And of course, Georges Sarret always took most of the payoff for himself. Because he felt himself to be the ringleader and the brilliant mastermind and all that stuff. And he also had a little bit of leverage over the girls because, I'm not sure if they were legal residents of France. And also, there apparently had been some accusation of spying for the Germans in World War I. Oh. Remember, this is the between the wars period right now. So there was that. You threatened to raise that issue again. Of course, they were the ones who were actually poisoning their husbands. So you could always rat them out to the police if they made a stink about anything.
It's true.
So he was taking the bulk of it. And Chambon du Verger and the girls didn't get the lion's share. Yeah.
This insurance fraud scheme was very profitable. Mm-hmm. It's unknown how many people the little gang killed, but it was enough, I'm pretty certain.
Yeah.
But they caught a lucky break.
They caught an unlucky break.
Yeah, they caught an unlucky break. Depends on how you define it.
Yeah.
They pulled a variation of their usual scheme. Katharina Schmidt impersonated a woman named Magali Herben. And insured herself for $1 million. Hmm. The plan was just to quietly pay the premiums for a year or two and then discreetly bump off Madame Herbin. Mm-hmm. But fate reared its ugly head. Madame Herbin almost immediately caught pneumonia and died.
Uh-huh.
That is a pretty funny little twist.
Yeah, they weren't expecting that, were they?
Right. So this is like put the high beams on them.
Yeah. So yeah, this is like probably the first time ever that this little trio of sociopaths found themselves actually upset that someone had died.
Well, of course, the insurance company was suspicious, and they went and had a chat with the police. Georges Sarret was the beneficiary of the policy, so they checked out his house in Marseille. Under a boulder in the back garden, they found a huge stash of bones, rats, cats, and dogs, and they all showed signs of acid damage.
Hmm. Like, it's almost as if he'd been experimenting around with dissolving corpses in sulfuric acid, perhaps.
Oh, yeah. It's like, what was her name? The lady from England who was experimenting with poisoning cats and dogs and stuff in the neighborhood.
Yeah, that's just, I remember
Edmonds,
her. Yeah.
Catherine Edmonds. Or
I hate that. Just leave the poor cats and dogs out of it, people. You know what I'm saying?
stick to old pensioners. They deserve it more. Anyway, criminals. Let's just not poison anyone.
There is that, too. It actually is a very inhumane way to kill anybody. You know, just shoot them in the head, for Christ's sakes. You know, but there was nothing to prove insurance fraud or any other foul play. I mean, well, foul, I guess, yeah, but nothing illegal, apparently. So the case was closed. But this stash of acid-eaten bones would later come back to haunt Sarret. Surprise. Yeah, the police would remember this. Yeah, surprise, surprise.
You'd think that would stick in someone's mind.
Yeah, it would. It's disturbing, don't you think? A little bit?
I think so. I would be disturbed if I saw that.
Yeah.
But there was nothing to prove insurance fraud or any other foul play, so the case was ultimately closed.
Yeah.
But not long after that, Sarret rented a villa outside of Marseille, from M. Poncel.
Monsieur Poncel.
Yeah, we don't know his first name.
Damn it.
He was going to Italy for a vacation, and so Sarret and the Schmidt sisters moved in, and Louis Chambon du Verger and his mistress showed up there as well by invitation.
An invitation to murder. Ooh. Yeah. But, shh. Yeah.
You're spoiling it.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, because Chambon had been demanding a bigger cut of the insurance proceeds. Probably reasonably so. You know, he was doing his bit, and he was essential to the whole thing. He had hinted, apparently, I don't know if he had hinted or not, that he might drop a dime on Sarret if he didn't come up with more cash. But Sarret apparently just, I don't know, felt he was a security threat or just maybe felt he was getting a little greedy. So he invited him up to the villa, I'm assuming with a promise of money. And Chambon should have insisted on meeting at a Starbucks instead.
Someplace public.
Yeah, bad move going up there. Yeah.
Agree.
Yeah.
So when Chambon and his girlfriend showed up, Katharina Schmidt started up a motorcycle in the courtyard of the villa and started revving it up really high, you know, and that was to create cover, right? To create a whole
racket noise. Yeah.
Gunshots as Sarret murdered Chambon and his mademoiselle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah. But then, as always, it was time to get rid of the bodies. And this is where the acid bath comes into play.
Yeah.
Sarret hadn't planned ahead. He first had to make a run into Marseille to buy a bathtub. He brought back to the village. It didn't have a bathtub there.
I think it had a bathtub, but he didn't know one way or the other if that the acid was going to destroy the bathtub or not.
Yeah, you know? It could. And sulfuric acid is really tough on stuff, but enamel holds up against it well.
Yeah.
I know this from my work as a custodian, not because I'm an acid bath killer.
Yeah. Well, here's my favorite part, though, is when he drops off the bathtub and then he tells the girls to babysit the bodies while he goes out and rounds up some acid.
Yeah, fun. Make sure they don't get back up.
Yeah, I know. So they got to stay there with the smelly, creepy corpses while he went to town for a few days. Apparently, it took him at least a couple of days to come back. And it can't take that long to go out and buy sulfuric acid. He must have gone out partying.
Good point.
Yeah, I don't know. What was he doing? I don't know what he was up to, but it took him a couple of days to come back. But, he had a car, so he returns in a few days with 26 gallons of sulfuric acid in the back of his car, which would be, that sounds like kind of a hazard.
Well, yeah, I'd be getting you in a fender bender with that, and you're in big trouble. Is a story we're going to cover sometime about someone who was in a truck filled with acid, and
it
is unknown if the person disappeared or was dissolved by his own payload.
Oh, ouch. Yeah, that's... Yeah. sucks.
But yeah. That's a podcast for another time.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I don't know how things worked back then, but you'd have to imagine, you know, the 26 gallons is a lot.
Yeah. I think it came in glass jugs the old fashioned kind that are kind of wrapped in a wicker cover, you know, but they're glass jugs. Yeah.
You'd pretty much, I mean, I know today we have different plastics that can contain it, but sulfuric acid is so incredibly corrosive that there's not, you know, that you have to transport it in very specific things.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I assume he drove very, very carefully. But and I don't know why they had a car. I don't know why they didn't just take the bodies out into the woods and bury them. It just seems to me, because it seems less messy than the whole acid thing.
It's a good point.
But, yeah. You know, whatever. The acid thing is what they did. Okay. They immersed them in the acid in the bathtub until everything, you know, bones, tissue, teeth, everything had dissolved, or at least pretty much dissolved. I mean, things like teeth, I don't know. Yeah.
Take a long time to break down.
Yeah, it really would. And I'm not sure. They didn't spend probably more than a couple of days doing this. It'll break down most everything. But and then, you know, you'd have some bones left over. You can always break those up with a hammer or something. but mostly what was left was just this disgusting, nasty sludge that was mostly just human body fat. And they scooped that into pails out of the bathtub and dumped it in a back corner of the garden, which – again, it's a little sloppy. I mean, I would have, at the very least, maybe if I was going to dump it in the garden, I would have gotten a shovel and dug a hole, you know, dump it in the hole and then fill it in on tops, you know, but they didn't do that.
It's kind of, I guess I've never dissolved up any, like, you know, meat and bone in acid, but
yeah,
it's got a smell. I mean, you know, when we've used acid-based cleaners, it's got quite the odor when it reacts with anything organic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. That's the other reason I would never choose this particular method, because it's kind of a giveaway. It would probably put out some really foul odors, and you know, somebody might smell it. And
human fats and stuff, it cannot smell good.
Yeah, so that's another reason to not go with this particular method. But whatever. That's what they did. So the bodies have been converted into that disgusting sludge, which wound up out in the garden.
So when the owner, Monsieur Poncel, returned from his vacation in Italy, he found just like this big, disgusting mess.
A little bit, yeah.
In the garden. The dining room floor had been ruined by stains, blood, acid, both. I'm not really sure. Mm-hmm. He also discovered there was this huge, you know, putrid, stinking, gross puddle in his garden. So he went to the cops.
Yeah. and the cops, of course, remembered that pile of acid-eaten animal bones that they had found in George Salle's garden. Yeah. So they hauled him in, and the Schmidt sisters as well. And after many hours of interrogation, Katharina Schmidt finally confessed. Yeah. And as you can imagine, the trial got a lot of publicity, which is undoubtedly how John George Haig came to hear about this handy way of disposing of corpses, right? Yeah. Acid. Okay. Yeah.
It works. Mm-hmm. So Georges Alexander Soret was convicted for his acid bath murders. He was sentenced to death. The Schmidt sisters, they got 10 years each for hard labor, and they probably should have been executed themselves.
They were involved in all these killings. I mean, they were totally into it. So, but
yeah. Well, okay. So then that's my question is, did George Sarray, did he ever get convicted of any of his other crimes? Did the Schmidt sisters ever get convicted for any of their other insurance frauds?
Not that I know of. I think they contented themselves with this double murder and decided they weren't going to prove anything else.
Legally, obviously France, this is a long time ago. France has different legal codes. I could see them being tried as accomplices, and maybe that doesn't carry the death penalty. Mm-hmm. George did the shooting, right? They were, of course, aware of it. But then after you serve the seniors as an accomplice, what about all those other people that you help bump off?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would say that they should go down for that. And that I'm not an expert on early 20th century French law. I'm pretty sure all that would add up to a death penalty.
If nothing else, to life in prison, or send them off to Devil's Island or something, you know, get rid of them. But, you know, they sort of disappear from the story. I don't know what in the end happened to them. maybe the authorities just felt like, you know, they actually made him do their 10 years and then threw him out of the country and sent him back to Germany.
Maybe sent him back to Germany.
Yeah, let the Germans, let it be Germany's problem. But could have been. Yeah, they would have been getting out of prison, I don't know, about 1944 if they served the full 10 years. Perfect time to send him back to Germany. Yeah, but so Sarai was on April 10th, 1934, Sarai was guillotined in the street in front of the city hall, the city of Aix-en-Provence, which is about 20 miles north of Marseille.
Why there?
I'm not sure. I'm not really sure if that was like maybe the provincial capital of that area. Maybe that's where the trial was and everything. But that's where it was. And they did it the old-fashioned French Revolution way, right in the street. It wasn't, it wasn't behind closed doors. It was right out there. There was a big crowd showed up to watch. They actually continued the guillotining kind of past this. Actually, the last guillotining in France was in 1977.
I've heard about this.
I was kind of surprised that it even went on this long. I thought it sort of faded away about the turn of the century, but no, they kept up with it for a while.
But
what the hell, you know, it's probably probably no nastier way to die than hanging or, you know, or like probably better than the electric chair, really. So they're all set up to lop his head off, and it went off fairly smoothly, except that the blade got jammed about halfway down.
Oh my God.
They were all like, he's down there with his head on the block, and the blade
just
like,
left him in place. They didn't move him while they worked on
it. Yeah, they just left him down there strapped in place. You know, I was like, they probably figured out, screw you, you know, you're a murdering bastard, you know, the hell with you. And they spent about 10 minutes or so tinkering with their little machine there until they got the blade moving smoothly again. It's like, okay, let's go. and then they finished the whole thing off. Sarai was apparently irritated by the whole situation. Mm-hmm. He probably felt it was undignified. It probably was a little uncomfortable too, frankly. But
yeah, it's probably not. Yeah, probably a little still. Like
he probably felt that he should be allowed to just sit up and smoke a last cigarette and have a shot of brandy or something. But you know, again, they just figured like, yes, the hell with you, dude. But
oh my God.
Yeah. So eventually the guillotine was functioning smoothly and his head was separated from his shoulders. And that's the end of that. Roll credits. Yeah.
And heads.
Yes.
But wait, there's more. We mentioned him earlier.
Hold those credits. Oh, yeah. Yeah. John George Hague.
Yeah.
But wait, before we do that, there's something important our listeners are going to want to hear, which is a message from our sponsors. Yeah,
you're going to really want to hear about these sponsors.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah.
They're freaking great, guys.
They sell fantastic stuff that you're going to want to buy.
I don't know who they are, but I know they're incredible.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Buy their stuff.
So we'll be right back.
Okay.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, so we're back. And now we're going to talk about somebody else who is vying for the title of top acid bath killer.
Ooh.
And that is John George Hague.
Yeah, we mentioned him a little earlier. Yeah,
he started out his killing spree about 10 years later in England. Hague gets one mark in his favor right out of the box. He was actually called the acid bath murderer.
So yeah.
And he's kind of got the title already.
Yeah.
But for a while, the press called him the vampire, because he claimed to drink the blood of his victims.
Whoa. This guy's
some Halloween-y stuff right there, man.
That was good.
Keeping it rolling.
Yeah, no, he was not. He was just angling for an insanity defense, apparently. Started making these ludicrous claims about vampirism, claiming that he drank the blood of his victims. He also claimed to be having these recurring, really dramatic nightmares of a twisted religious variety with lakes of blood and forests of trees transforming themselves into crucifixes and yada, 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 yada. And there's no evidence he ever actually drank anybody's blood. He was definitely a sociopath. And as you'll see, and definitely a serial killer. But he was not insane in the typical sense that we would think of it as. He knew perfectly well what he was that what he was doing was wrong. He just didn't give a damn. He would murder people with wealthy people, dispose of their assets for profit, pocket the money. He was not motivated by an urge to kill people for the sheer fun of it. He wasn't really into killing people, but he had no qualms about doing it if necessary. But he just did it because it was necessary for his business, for him to make get money to live off of. Yeah.
Wow. What a
yeah.
What a winner.
Yeah.
But so he thought he was like real clever.
He did. Yeah.
That his insanity claims were going to be bought by the jury, and they just weren't. But we're getting a little ahead of ourselves. So let's go back.
There was a jury eventually. Yeah.
Back to 1909.
1909. What happened in 1909? Oh, yeah. He was born. Yeah.
He was born.
Yeah. He was born in Lincolnshire, which, of course, is east of Sheffield.
Yeah, I knew that.
There you go. Wow.
I have no idea where Lincolnshire is.
Yeah.
It makes it easier. It's about 100 miles north of Londinium.
Londinium, yes.
His parents were well off, so no claims of childhood privation to tug at our hearts here.
Mm.
His folks were also very religious, members of a fringe Protestant sect calling themselves the Plymouth Brethren. John had a very strict religious upbringing, which obviously didn't really take,
apparently not. But yeah, his parents, I don't think they were harsh. I don't think they like beat him or anything like that, but they, he was expected to like read the Bible a lot, and he did. But again, it didn't take. And like you say, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. John was, he was a bright kid, actually. He got a reasonably good education, although he never went to the university. He maybe possibly could have had the opportunity to do so, but I think he really kind of lacked the patience for it. I don't think he was really interested in going off and studying philosophy or law or whatever. I think he just was ambitious and wanted to start making money. Because that's what he wanted. That sort of defines this guy as greed. He was like, so he started out his fairly young, maybe 19 even. He got a job working for a motor company. And apparently he conceived his first swindle while working there. He started selling non-existent cars to people under a false name. And, managed to make himself a little money that way. But eventually...
So how did it work selling non-existent cars to people?
I'm not really sure exactly how it worked. I mean, if he was like doing it under a fake name with a fake address, et cetera, I assume that he would contact people and get them to send a deposit for this really cool car that they wanted. And then he would just sort of,
That makes sense.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Probably, I mean, so much stuff was done via mail back in those days and things. Mm-hmm. So it probably was a lot easier to get away with stuff like this back in those days.
You're pre-ordering. You're making fake pre-orders.
Yeah.
People still do that. We'll take an order for the new iPhone.
Yeah, exactly. And if you have an official enough looking a nice address in a nice area of London with a really official looking letterhead on your stationery and stuff, at least some people are probably going to get fooled by that and send you money. Absolutely. Yeah, but eventually the law did catch up with him, and he wound up going off to prison for his first stint. He did several stints in prison, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In between jailhouse stints, in 1936, he moved to London and took a job as an assistant chauffeur to one William McSwan. McSwan would have the distinction of being his first murder victim, but this was still a few years out.
Quite a few years, actually. But
McSwan owned some game arcades, places full of pinball machines or whatever they were doing in the 1930s.
The Blinko, equivalent.
Did they have Blinko back then?
Yeah, I think it might have been Blinko. But Blinko. Do we need to explain to our listeners what pinball machines are?
No.
People still
I'm
know.
I'm assuming they know.
Yeah,
they still have them. There's still pinball machines.
There's still pinball around? Okay. Oh, I mean, it seems to me, I see. Yeah, yes, that's good. I'm glad pinball is still around.
Pinball's awesome.
Pinball is very cool. It really is. Let's see what else McSwan. William McSwan also managed his parents' real estate properties. His parents were actually kind of rich, owned a lot of property. And eventually, John Haig would recognize this for the opportunity that it was. But he was not yet to that stage of his criminal career. He was still doing small-time fraud and actually making some decent money at it. While he was working for McSwan, he was, again, being an assistant chauffeur, et cetera. He also created a false identity. He called himself William Cato Adamson, solicitor. Yeah.
That's a I like that one.
Yeah, he was a
Tito Adams.
Yes, and he had offices all over the UK. He pretended to represent the heirs of wealthy estates who were eager to cash out their parents' assets or their grandparents or whoever that was that would had died. And what Haig would do is he'd tell his marks that, you know, he had these people who really wanted their money now and wanted to cash out now. And so he was able to offer his mark lots of high quality stock at fire sale prices.
Whoa.
And so a lot of people fell for the scheme and then bought this stock, which, of course, you know, it didn't actually exist.
Right.
Yeah. But of course, eventually somebody smelled a rat and spoke to the police, and off Haig goes to prison again.
So after he got out, he got a job selling insurance. And again, he set up a fraudulent side business.
This guy's
terrible, man.
He is, yeah. Or was, I should say. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was in fake insurance policies. And again, he ended up going to jail. And it was during this stint in jail that he apparently reportedly began to experiment with acid and not in the fun way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think not that kind of acid. No.
They didn't have that kind of acid back then.
Yeah. I think
Hoffman, Hoffman was still a few years out.
I think that he began to decided to kind of revise his approach to the whole thing about fraud and everything like that.
Yeah.
A lot of people have said that the lesson he learned was he needed to eliminate his victims so that they couldn't rat on him. But the problem was, is he had a lot of victims. All of his previous schemes had involved a lot of fairly small fraudulent transactions with a lot of people. And every one of those transactions involved risk. Any one of those could land him in jail. So I think he decided, why not instead do just a few really big swindles instead?
I mean, if you look at it, if you look at the way, at least in the United States, I'm sure it's like this in probably every country in the world. Mm-hmm. The law rewards you for stealing big.
It does. Yeah. A bank, if you rob a bank of $50 million, they are probably more likely going to want to just cover it up. They'll probably, you know,
also like the way the statutes are written, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like you go to jail for stealing, you go to jail for about the same amount of time as if you steal $50,000 versus, you know, $500,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
I mean, that's one of the most common pieces of advice I hear from people is just steal big. If you're going to do it, make sure you get a big haul because the time's about the same.
Absolutely. Yeah. But the problem here is that he was thinking correctly here with his new business plan. But the problem is if you pick a really rich victim and you proceed to relieve him of his bank accounts and his real estate and then all of his other assets, the guy's going to notice, right? So the only way to really make this work would be to kill the victim and essentially assume his identity, at least on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that John George Haig had another talent that really suited him to this scheme, which is that he was a naturally talented forger. And he could fake other people's handwriting and their signatures on, you know, legal documents and stuff.
There you go.
Handy, right?
No, totally.
Yeah. Now,
Haig began to experiment with dissolving mice in sulfuric acid.
That's what I remember. He's still in prison.
Yeah. So he's in the jailhouse.
Yeah.
Somehow, who lets an inmate get their hands on sulfuric acid? This is an awful idea.
Well, it turns out.
I know it's useful for cleaning some things, but seriously, that's not. You should have no. At the very least, no unsupervised time with sulfuric acid in prison.
You wouldn't think, but apparently he'd been given a work detail, and this particular prison had a tinning shop.
Yeah. I guess so. Yeah, no, that does make sense. Like, yeah, a lot of jewelry and things like that use sulfuric acid. Oh, my God.
Anyway,
doubt he got his inspiration to put the poor mice into the acid bath from Georges Alexandre Sarre.
Yeah. Huh?
Of course, he'd heard of Sarre. Everybody had.
Yeah.
It was a very notorious case. And it had been all over the papers.
Yeah.
So as luck would have it, John Hay had been working in this tinning shop, and he's got
access
to acid. You probably need to explain what tinning is, right?
Tinning is just basically like metal plating, essentially, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there was some sulfuric, yeah. Yeah. And so he had some sulfuric acid to work with. And no doubt the prison had a pretty plentiful supply of rodents to work with as well. Yeah. I hope that he killed the poor little critters before he dropped them in the acid.
Oof, yeah, I was thinking the same thing. I really hope he killed him. I mean, I guess you can kind of comfort yourself in that he was a sociopath. I've never heard anything about him being especially sadistic.
Yeah.
It's probably safer to drop a dead mouse in acid since it's not going to thrash around and splash sulfuric acid on you.
No, very true. It is. It's like I say, he was a sociopath. He wouldn't have actually been particularly troubled by doing something horrible to mice, but he wouldn't have gotten any joy out of it either.
Easier to get him already dead, pull him out of a mouse trap, and drop him in.
Yeah, pretty much. And that's
by timing the dissolution of the mice, Haig worked out that he could dissolve a human body in just 2 short days.
Oh, nice.
So after he got out of jail again, he ran into his old pal, William McSwan, in a London pub.
Ran into, huh? Really? Yeah. You think that was an accident? Or do you think
it was an accident? Maybe, but I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either. So Haig and McSwan started hanging out again. McSwan introduced Haig to his rich parents, which again might have been chance, but I'm kind of guessing that Haig probably maneuvered him into that too, right? Mm-hmm. We don't know, but Haig became friends with the McSwans as well, and sometimes he would assist William with his rent collections and other stuff. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, he also rented some basement shop space in London. A place that happened to have a really nice drain in the floor. Yeah, a nice drain connecting to the sewers. That's handy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he brought in a big oil drum, you know, big enough to hold a body, and a bunch of sulfuric acid. And then he lured his friend William down there, bopped him on the back of the head with a pipe. Reportedly, the first blow didn't entirely do the trick, so he had to take a few more whacks at his head to finish the job.
Ouch.
Ugh, yeah.
And remember, this is Haig's friend, right?
Does Haig really have friends?
No, he never really did.
I mean, McSwan might have thought they were friends.
I mean, this guy was probably the closest thing that Haig had to a friend, but he didn't really actually have friends. I don't think he was, but, you know, still, you know, you'd think I don't know how long, so many years of hanging out with the guy, you know, you'd think he would have felt something, but no, he was remorseless. Just a complete sociopath.
Yeah.
But again, there's nothing in his history to indicate that he enjoyed killing. It was a means to an end. It didn't seem to bother him in the slightest to kill his friend. But on the other hand, if there had been nothing to gain by killing William, he wouldn't have done it.
Yeah, that's true.
He would not have done it. Yeah, yeah.
Greedy. So William is slid into the barrel and copious amounts of acid poured in over him. Mm. And after 2 days, Peg poured the sludge down the basement drain.
Uh-huh. Easy.
Easy peasy.
Yeah.
Now, this is, you got to remember, Joe, this is September of 1944, and so the war in Europe is still going on, and Haig contrived an excuse for his friend's absence. He'd nipped off to Scotland to avoid conscription into the military.
Not a bad idea.
I guess. So Haig contacted Donald and Amy McSwan and told them that William had flown the coop, but that he would eventually be in touch. He also told that William asked to stay in his house and asked him.
He wanted. Yeah, sorry. Okay. Yeah.
Yes. So William asked John George to stay in his house and look after it in his absence. It
nice.
Was, you know, yeah. And he was willing to do that. Such a nice guy.
I know. So
he offered to help them out by taking over William's duties until he got back from Scotland.
Nice guy. Yeah.
What a saint.
And as time went by, kept the story up by sending the occasional postcard from Scotland to the McSwans.
Nice.
Remember, he was a forger. He was able to fake his handwriting pretty nice. Just occasionally would hop on the train to Scotland, mm-hmm. buy a postcard, scribble a message out, and drop it in the mail, and jump mm-hmm. back on the train and go back to London.
You can always put the postcard in a bigger envelope and send it to someone you know and have them mail it back.
You could do that too. Yeah, I don't know exactly how he set that whole thing up. And meantime, he was helpful to the McSwans. He helped out with the rent collections. He didn't steal anything from them because he wanted to keep their trust, you know. And he continued to live rent-free in William's house. And slowly he drained his bank accounts, you know, because mm-hmm. William did have some money.
Yeah, that's kind of wow. So when the war wound down, the McSwans began asking Haig where William was and when he was coming home. The cover story just really wasn't going to last that much longer. It was going to hold up. So on July 2nd, 1945, Haig invited them over to his basement shop. He told them William was back from Scotland and staying there temporarily. But of course, there was no William there, just a pipe and two drums and a lot of jugs full of sulfuric acid. The McSwans met the same end as their son, which is sad.
Yeah.
And Haig was able to use his forging skills and con man's charms to sell off all of their properties and pocket the cash.
So, substantial sum of money, by the way.
Yeah, how much was it?
It was about, I've heard, around 8,000 pounds, maybe more, which doesn't seem like a lot, but actually back then it was quite a bit. The average wage was, I hear, about 5 pounds a week. Okay. So John Haig could have actually lived on that, assuming he lived, you know, reasonably modestly. He could have lived off that for years, maybe decades. But he liked living high on the hog, and he liked to gamble. Well, what an idiot. I mean, seriously. I mean, but so within a few years, he was running out of money. Had to find a new victim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he found his next victim through the want ads.
Of course.
Dr. Archibald Henderson and his wife Rose were trying to sell their house for 9,000 pounds.
Yeah, I think it was 9,000, 9,500, somewhere around there. Anyway, okay. Yeah.
That's good money.
Yeah.
That meant they'd soon have a large amount of cash for him to take possession of.
Yeah.
He contacted them.
Or a piece of real estate that he could take possession of and sell off, assuming that they hadn't sold it yet. Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he contacted them and expressed strong interest in the property. Thanks to his charm school ways and his con man's skills to pay the bills, he managed to worm his way into their confidence and even got invited over to their house a few times. There, he managed to rifle through their drawers and he found a .38 revolver. Oh. He would later use that to murder them.
Handy, yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Is that right?
He'd even got himself a new shop where he'd pre-positioned a few drums and a lot of acid. And he asked Archie Henderson to come to the shop and check out his cool new invention.
Which was what?
Cheese straightener,
perpetual motion mouse trap. I don't know.
Right.
But yeah, of course, when Archie gets there, the new invention, it was just a shot to the back of the head. He was, stuffed into a drum. Mm-hmm. But the acid didn't quite start yet because Haig needed to get Rosie over there too. So he calls her and tells her that Archie was sick and wasn't able to drive himself. And so could she come by and get him? And so she did, and she wound up in the other drum. And now it's time to pour the acid in.
Yeah, but see, the problem was that his new shop didn't have a floor drain, which is some pretty awful planning on his part.
Yeah.
But there was some yard space and a big pile of rocks.
Yeah, it was like rocks and debris and stuff like that in the back. Yeah, so good place to pour your gunk, right? Okay. I guess.
So Haig dumps the sludge from the barrels over the rock pile. The next rainfall washed the gunk down into the rocks. So boom, out of sight, out of mind.
I guess. Yeah.
I don't know. This does not seem like a great plan to me.
No. Haig
used his forgery skills to sell off the Hendersons' properties and pocket the cash, and once again he ended up with around 8,000 British pounds.
Yeah, and he breezed through it pretty much. He was a moron. I mean, if he had just gotten a job, between his wages and all this cash that he had on hand, he could have lived pretty well. Really,
yeah.
I mean, but he was lazy. Plus, he also just wanted to party and gamble and just live beyond his means. But he was speaking of which he was living in the Onslow Court Hotel in Kensington, London.
Whoa.
Which was a pretty nice place. At least
I don't know. Someone says Onslow Court Hotel of Kensington. I think that's got to be a nice spot.
Yeah, I know. Pretty expensive. And, you know, again, he could have just rented a nice flat for a lot cheaper, I'm sure. But no.
Yeah,
no,
right.
But, oh, well.
Yep. So one of his fellow guests was a wealthy widow, Olive Durand Deacon. Haig was passing himself off as an engineer this time, and she had mentioned to him that she had a cool idea for a new product, artificial fingernails.
What? Fake fingernails? That's ridiculous. Who would ever buy something like that?
Did Olive Durand Deacon invent press-ons?
I don't know, actually. I think that she had this idea, but I don't think that she lived long enough to actually bring it to market. So it probably just sort of went the way of the dodo and somebody else came up with the idea years later.
Crazy.
I don't know.
Haig invited Olive down to his workshop almost exactly 1 year after he'd murdered the Hendersons there.
His engineering workshop where they could work out all the details of her cool plan for artificial robotic fingernails.
Got a big drum full of something that'll really help artificial fingernails get invented. Look in there.
Yeah, but again, yeah, this was almost exactly 1 year. This is like 1 year and several days after he murdered the Hendersons there, right?
Oh, man. So, so he shoots her in the back of the head, and he did his usual drum and acid thing. And he took all of her jewelry and her food. Took her fur coat, which is a bad move because the police later found it, and that's it's fairly incriminating.
He actually, the coat, apparently when he shot her, he got blood on her nice fur coat, and instead of just like throwing it in a dumpster somewhere or something like that, being
dropping it in the acid,
or that too, being the greedy person that he was, he wanted to keep it and sell it, so he took it to a dry cleaner's and left it off there to be cleaned. And of course, the police, when they were later on, they ran across the dry cleaning receipt among his stuff, and go to the dry cleaners and look at that. There's a beautiful fur coat that all of his friends identified as being hers. That's a little incriminating. That was just dumb.
Right.
Not exactly a criminal mastermind here.
No, he really isn't. Well, he seems like he's so organized, but then he misses little details like that. I don't know.
One really big detail, which is this. He violated the first rule of the serial killer code, which is don't crap where you eat. And Olive lived in the same hotel as he did, that's just right. Which brought him up. Yeah.
They probably knew that they were hanging out together. People
saw them. Yeah, they did.
So when police started investigating, looking for likely perpetrators, the guy with the criminal history and no visible means of supporting himself moved up the suspect list pretty quickly. The cops searched his rooms, because of course he had more than one.
Yeah.
And he had a suite or something.
Yeah.
And some of Olive's jewelry was found there.
Yeah.
They also found a receipt from a dry cleaning shop. And that's where they did the fur coat thing.
Yep.
They tracked down Haig's shop in Sussex and looked closely at the rock pile in the backyard. And they found 28 pounds of human body fat.
Ew, along gross. With
part of a human foot and part of a denture.
Yeah, which was, by the way, identified by Olive's dentist as belonging to her.
Aww.
So yeah, Haig was a little sloppy on this one. I would dump the thing, and if there was anything like half a foot laying there on the ground or something like that, I would probably take it back inside and put it in the acid again or something, But
yeah,
he got a little cocky, I think. I don't know, man.
But just don't dump it in your own backyard. Find someplace to put it in the river or something.
Do something. Yeah, throw it in a dumpster. I don't know. But the police also, in searching his stuff, they found documents that connected him to the disappearances of the McSwan family and the Hendersons. So, it was the jig was up for our acid bath murderer, who confessed, by the way, and he was actually happy to confess because he believed falsely that since there was no body left, that he could not be convicted of murder. Well, he was wrong on that one. He was wrong on that. But he went ahead and confessed. He said, I killed the McSwans. I killed Olive. I killed the Hendersons. I killed three other people as well. Ha ha.
The no body, no trial thing only works if you don't confess.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly it. He had confessed. And plus, of course, there was also enough of Olive's body left behind, and the denture and also the fur and the jewelry, et cetera, et cetera. So, there was more than enough to take this to a jury and get a conviction. So.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing he was overconfident about was his ability to convince a jury that he was insane.
He told these stories. We talked about the vampirism, but it didn't really seem to mostly just fall on deaf ears. In my opinion, is that the jury just really didn't give a damn if he was insane or not. He did the stuff. He probably would do it again.
I think that's it. I don't think they gave a damn. I think it was like, screw you, dude, you're dangerous. I want to see you hang. So that's what happened to him.
I think so. I think if there was a good prosecuting attorney or whatever they call them over there, it would be in his interest to be like, this guy's telling you he's crazy, but what's the one thing we know about him is that he is a friggin' liar.
That's very, very true.
He will lie and scheme.
Yes, it so is.
Take that, take that for what it is.
This guy will, he will do whatever,
Right. He sure wasn't talking about, how insane he was and his weird dreams about crucifixes when he was living it up at the Hotel Oxnard Kensington. He was you know, he was fine then.
Yeah, to me, if I had been sitting on that jury, I would have been, well, okay, let's say you are crazy and a blood-drinking vampire. In my opinion, that makes you even more dangerous, so I want to see you hang. So there you go. Right. That's that.
Yeah. I mean, there's that, or yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the jury, they came back with a verdict of sane and also guilty.
Guilty is sin. Yes.
Guilty is sin. So he was
I think they came back after like 20 minutes or something too. It was a,
yeah,
it was
a quick one. I wouldn't need a long time if I was on that jury.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, he did confess. So yeah. After a lengthy appeals process, about 3 weeks.
Yeah.
They moved quick back then. He was strung up on August 10th, 1949. The hanging was carried out, and this is really cool, by famed British executioner Albert Pierrepont.
Yeah, who the guy who he killed hundreds. Or it didn't say killed. He wasn't a killer. He was an executioner. It was his job to hang people, and he hanged a lot of people in a very professional way, of course.
Yeah, he was apparently really good. He was the guy who did the handshake trick, right?
Yeah, and he also he eventually wrote his memoirs about it too. Interestingly enough, in the end, he actually kind of came out. He expressed some doubts in his book about the death penalty. He said he didn't actually believe it was a deterrent. Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, it didn't deter Haig, did it?
No, it did not. And you know what? One thing about it is that the death penalty was a much surer thing back in those days. You were much more likely to be sentenced to it. And you didn't, unlike today, you didn't get to spend 20, 30 years going through appeals. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And even then, people still killed each other left and right. So.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
All right. So let's, you promised me some juicy theories and I want some juicy ones.
I did. Yeah, no, I did. But you know what? I lied. We don't have any theories here.
This is like a mystery.
Yeah, okay. Aliens, Bigfoot. No. Okay. I did want to talk a little bit about
time traveling. Walter White apparently was
a
theory.
Well, there is that. Yeah, the proof of time travel.
he was just misunderstood.
I wanted to just a word of wisdom for all you budding serial killers out there. I know you guys listen to us for tips and pointers on how to get away with murder. And how to apply your trade. And I personally think there are better ways to get rid of bodies than dissolving them in acid. You know, it's messy and dangerous, smelly. You could be overcome by the fumes. The fumes are pretty toxic, I hear.
I've worked around different kinds of acids, including sulfuric acid, and you really got to watch your butt.
Yeah.
Make sure you have a well-ventilated space if you're going to use that for anything.
Yes, you do. And it's just messy, but also, you know, acid doesn't really get rid of a body. It just it just transforms it. It breaks it down. And it basically, sulfuric acid really reacts with water in a big way. Mm-hmm. It's an exothermic reaction, meaning that, among other things, it generates a lot of heat. And since we're mostly water, people are, that is, it essentially boils away our water content in a way. But there's a lot of muck left behind. It's corrosive also towards other parts of our innards, like bones and such as well. But still, you know, in the end, it doesn't matter how much acid you throw at it, it's not going to react with everything in your body. So a lot of stuff gets left behind. So you get this sort of acidic, smelly, disgusting, gross muck left behind that you've got to still get rid of.
Right. So, and which any forensic scientist will be able to trace back to a body.
Yeah.
And so you still have a body on your hands.
You do, essentially. And the thing about it that distinguishes it from, say, wrapping a body in plastic and stuffing it in your trunk and taking it out to the woods and burying it is that the body, you know, that you haven't dissolved is still a self-contained unit. As long as you wrap it and keep it carefully wrapped and sealed in plastic and everything, you're pretty good. Whereas with this stuff, when you got all this goo left over, it's messy and it'd be very easy to spill even just a little bit, you know, and it'd be really hard to clean up and absolutely know for sure that you've removed all traces of it from your little murder scene or wherever you're working. So again, I just think there's just too many. The only way it would make sense is if you're in a situation where you just can't truck a whole body out of your house or wherever and put it in the back of your car without being seen. It can't be done. That's the only, but even then, I think, you know, the alternative is like you either dissolve them in acid and take them out in jugs of disgusting goo, or you chop them up and take them out in, like, you know, garbage bags a little bit at a time. Both both of them sound, you know, hideously disgusting, and, you know.
Oh my God!
I mean, I all of them. I don't know. I mean, it's up to you. I just think. I have a better idea.
This is how I would do it.
What?
Don't murder people.
Yeah, there's that.
Then you never have any bodies to get rid of.
There's that.
Problem solved.
Don't
be a murderer.
There's that. You know, another way to do it is to just take them to wherever you plan to bury them and kill them there. Trick them. Yeah. Just say, hey, you know, I got this really cool place out in the woods where I dug a grave. I'd like you to see it. And they'll totally go along with that. And right. And then you just shoot them in the back of the head and they fall into the grave and it's easy. But but seriously, yeah, I mean, you're right. You are correct. It's better to just not kill people. And again, if you do have to kill somebody, just don't kill them in your house. I mean, kill them somewhere like, I don't know, say in an industrial building where you can drive your car into the building and privately, you know, load them in the back of your car without having to drag it outside where people might see you. I mean, okay, maybe that's totally. It. But again, just don't kill people to begin with. There's also that.
There's that.
All yeah. Right.
Well, on that note, I think we should wrap this one up.
Yeah. Are we gonna take a vote, or are we gonna leave this one up to our listeners?
Leave a vote on our Facebook page. Who do you think was better?
Yeah. Saleh, the French dude, who the French, Haig. Of course, have a disown, or Haig. Yeah. I don't know. It's so listeners, tell us.
All right.
Okay. And cool. That is it.
And don't forget to leave us a good rating and review. We really like that.
While you're at it. Yeah. If you've already left us a rating and review, well, just create another log in and leave another one. You know, hey, I mean, whatever it takes, we don't care.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And hang on just for a moment so you can hear important information about how to contact us via email or how to find us on social media. And
yeah, definitely.
That's about it. Until next week, toodaloo. Yeah.
All right, have a good one.
Bye.
The Shocking Details can be found at www.theshockingdetails.com. We're on Twitter at Shocking Details. For discussion of episodes and more, our Facebook group is facebook.com/groups/shockingdetailspodcast/. Or you can email us at theshockingdetailspodcast@gmail.com. And if you like the podcast, please consider giving us a like and a positive review and letting people know about us.
Can you hear Beans snoring?
I can, yeah.
Should I wake her up and tell her to stop snoring? Is it going to be an issue?
Move her. Can you move her a little bit?
Hey, buddy.
I feel bad.
Hey, buddy. Hi. Why? Hi. You were snoring. You know that? Yeah. It's okay. It's okay.
I was dreaming about attacking.
All right, buddy.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only, not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Get all the Masterforce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with Masterforce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with Masterforce power equipment at Menards. Save.